Hello and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast updates you with the expertise and current insight of the Washington, D.C.-based attorneys from the Fortney Scott Law Firm. Each episode highlights the most important issues and analysis that employers need to know in order to understand and react to key federal developments affecting their business. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice on any subject matter. Now let's turn it over to our host, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the DC Insider Podcast. This is David Fortney. I'm back in the driver's seat, the moderator seat this week, and joined again by Nita and Bert. Nita, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, David?
Good. Thank you. And thanks for being such a good moderator last time. It was great. I'd like to switch roles again. We'll do that. And Bert, how are you?
I'm kind of with you, David. Let's get Nita back in the driver's seat. But it's great to be back.
I agree. Well, we've got so much going on. And I really this time want to unpack some of the pay equity developments. So we recently had the 2022 Equal Pay Day. And several of our key agencies were, of course, very involved in doing that. But before we turn to that, we really have to, I think, spend a moment on what has been totally preoccupied everyone in Washington. And that's, of course, Judge Jackson and her confirmation. Who's got an observation on that?
David, I'll take that one first. The first impression, of course, is what an exceptional and outstanding nominee Judge Jackson is. From my point of view, probably the most depressing of all of the nominations. I've been a Supreme Court watcher since I was a kid. And this time, there was an embarrassing display of racism and misogyny. Can you imagine any man being asked about his work-life balance, for example, or the children's books he reads? We hope that there will be a confirmation. It was a pretty disheartening process.
It is true, I think, Bert and David, that we really have come down in the world as far as the way these confirmation hearings are. I mean, I think the Republicans can complain about what happened with their most recent Supreme Court justices, but this one seemed to be especially a circus and not focused at all on her qualifications or the historic nomination. She will be the first African-American woman to sit on the Supreme Court, which is an astonishing thing in our country.
Well, and I would certainly add, I agree with both of you. Certainly the manner in which she conducted herself was really impressive. And she did not, as they say, stoop to the bait that was put out there by more than one member. And I thought she conducted herself with exceeding high-level professionalism. I thought that part was very positive. We know one other thing that's been very positive in Washington, because I like being optimistic, are cherry blossoms. The cherry blossoms have just finished. They're still out there somewhat. Just drove by them yesterday, and they were still beautiful, although they peaked a couple days ago. There is a webcam, the cherry blossom cam, that you can get through the National Park Service that I would recommend if people still want to see the tail end of it. But it's lovely. And that, of course, is a lovely part of our traditions here in Washington, D.C. Well, let's turn and talk about the equal pay, because that's what the agencies are focusing on. We wish perhaps they would focus on cherry blossoms, but no, they really are focused on pay, and they made a concerted effort, of course, on Equal Pay Day recently. And of course, from our standpoint, Equal Pay Day was just last March 15th, but all the agencies came out, albeit with some different initiatives, with OFCCP really leading the pack with a new directive dealing with pay equity. But EEOC put an interesting press release. I'd like to talk a little bit about what their efforts have been and what their future plans are going to be on pay. And the president also with a new executive order dealing with whether federal applicants and potentially for federal contractors should be asked their prior pay when they're hired. And of course, many states have already imposed those types of restrictions. So I don't know that that made as much of a ripple, but it does represent, again, a coordinated, what is becoming the usual practice, coordinated approach between and among multiple agencies. And this time it was to focus on pay to mark Equal Pay Day. So let's first start with what the federal contractor requirements are, because I think that's where most of the action is. And Nita, why don't you lead us on that initially, please?
I'd be happy to do that. So where we are is under the federal regulations, and these were regulations that were issued in 2000. So they added a requirement. This is what the reg says. that the contractor must perform in-depth analysis of its total employment process to determine whether or where impediments to equal opportunities exist. At a minimum, the contractor must evaluate the compensation system to determine whether there are gender, race, or ethnic-based disparities. Now, this was put into the regs in 2000. Up until now, there has not really been much guidance. There's been a lot of fighting among and between contractors and OFCCP as to what that means. OFCCP tried to resolve that by issuing the first directive under Biden administration, which is 2022-01, which is the directive name. And it is requiring, it says that in order to be in compliance with this regulation, contractors must prepare what they're calling a pay equity audit annually in order to meet this requirement. Failure to prepare a pay equity audit is considered admission of noncompliance.
That one struck me when I first read it, because it's an unusual burden. It's an unusual remedy. And especially in light of the ambiguity as to what a pay equity audit is for purposes of this directive. But one of the things we have to recognize, whether we like it or not, is that requesting this kind of an analysis is really a function of the advances in technology. When OFCCP started, you need a room full of computers to do anything approaching a systemic analysis of a compensation system. You can do that now on a cell phone. So we have to examine what the OFCCP is asking for in light of current capabilities. But that still doesn't explain what it is that we have to produce. And I hope, David, you can help us understand what's acceptable.
Well, of course, that is the ultimate question. What is it a contractor now has to do? Remember, the regulatory obligation, as Nita described, it's to evaluate the compensation systems, Now we have the agency through sub-regulatory guidance saying you have to do a pay equity audit. Of course, this presumably is for each AAP establishment. It's for each functional affirmative action plan, each FAP, that you have to do this. And what is it? What is it? What is a pay equity audit? OFCCP has shared with us what it thinks it is, to some degree, which is these very robust groupings, statistical analysis, et cetera. But of course, I keep coming back to the regulatory language, because what OFCCP told the general public, the regulated public, when it promulgated its regulations was, this is not a big burden at all. You don't have to really do anything specifically. You can decide what to do, and you have great freedom to do that. So it seems to me they now, kind of through the back door, are trying to impose these much more demanding standards to do full-blown pay equity audits.
So this is not in the scheduling letter. This is going to be something that they're going to ask from contractors if they find concerns, and I am assuming they're going to always find concerns about promotion, assignment, steering, and so forth. But in that situation, they're A, going to ask for your pay equity audit, whatever that is. They may ask for pay groupings, interviews, variables used. What were the disparities that were found? What did you do with the disparities? They may even ask for more data, like experience, prior experience for these people, or education. And finally, David, I thought the most interesting thing is they're going to ask, so when you got the disparities, what'd you tell management about them? Then what'd you do about them? And this places, I think, employers or contractors in particular in a very awkward position.
Follow-on requests, as you've described them, Nita, indicate that the agency envisions a much more robust set of analytics than most contractors currently do to fulfill its regulatory obligations. Most are doing cohort analyses, perhaps simple averages or median analyses, maybe a wage gap study. All of those, I think, effectively address the regulatory requirement of compensation system. But of course, what the agency is now doing, not through rulemaking, but through this sub-regulatory guidance, is trying to impose much more significant efforts and assessments. And of course, lawyers are always part of that, and they did address that too, didn't they, Bert? The role of lawyers and what's privileged, which is a whole third rail they've touched.
Yeah, I think in many respects, from a lawyer's point of view, this is the most controversial part of this entire directive, because the OFCC asserts in a sub-regulatory directive, which is really kind of advice to itself, announcing to the world what it's going to do. It says that in the past, most of these fancy compensation analytics were carefully done under the privilege of attorney-client privilege and work product privilege. And whenever the contractor was asked to produce them, they said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. They're protected by privilege. In this directive, in this sub-regulatory conversation with itself, the agency is asserting that if a pay equity analysis is requested, it must be produced regardless of privilege because it is being required by regulation. And just give me a second to tell you about privilege. It's the core of the Anglo-Saxon legal system. It's what creates the confidence between a client and an attorney to speak candidly, and neither party can be compelled to disclose those conversations or productions. However, there are two kinds of privilege. One is called the work product privilege, and you get that privilege if what you're creating, the product, is in anticipation of litigation. In the past, the fact that an audit was in the offing usually sufficed. However, it is true that if the product at issue is something that you have to produce anyway, like an environmental statement or something of that kind, that you must produce it. However, there's another privilege called the attorney-client privilege, and that is absolute, and it goes to any conversation, any disclosure, and any product made that is giving legal advice between an attorney and a client. And I think we're going to have some real fights because lawyers of all kinds, defense, management, labor, defendant, plaintiff, all care about and all rely on privilege. So there's going to be a real debate about just what is protected. And David, perhaps you can help us identify the other critical areas that continue to be protected by privilege, even if a document that is produced by dint of regulation and must be shared with the agency.
Sure. So it looks like at this point, putting aside whether there are challenges to this directive or whether it's even binding, putting those aside, it does appear that at least there's a path that contractors that don't want to engage in a big litigation dust up with the agency can begin to embark on. Number one, you start to prepare some sort of comp analysis per the regulatory requirement, as Bert just laid out. Nita gave us that reg standard right at the top. You produce a assessment for each AAP, each establishment, or FAP, functional AAP, if you happen to have one of those. And you do so in a manner that you can provide it to the agency. That, of course, in our view, would not require you to disclose any privileged communications that may have surrounded the preparation of that, as Bert has explained, and that is completely separate and independent of the recommended course of action that annually you do conduct pay equity assessments. That is to assess compliance under Title VII. There is one good news item in this directive. The agency expressly recognizes in the directive that if you do those independent studies to evaluate pay equity, they properly can be privileged and not subject to disclosure to the OFCCP during an audit. So that, I think, is very positive.
Well, David, for those contractors who are looking to do the move and register and certify their compensation, what do we recommend? What are we thinking about recommending to them? Because they have to meet this regulatory obligation in order to certify to OFCCP they're in compliance.
Right. And this is the practical problem because honestly, up to this point, this regulation has been viewed as imposing a fairly low obligation in terms of doing some rudimentary basic assessment of whether your compensation is sufficient. Obviously, the agency wants more at a minimum. Because what Nita's referring to is that new certification that all federal contractors have to do by June 30th, that they are in compliance with all the requirements, including the requirement we're discussing here, the compensation evaluation of the compensation system. So you need to have something you can point to that arguably meets it. Does it have to be as detailed as the pay equity study this directive talks about, all due respect to OFCCP, I don't think the regulation requires that. Some contractors will opt to do that because they don't want to risk having controversy if they're audited. But in terms of what the actual regulation says and what the agency has historically said, it does not require a full-blown pay equity assessment as it's been spelled out in this current directive.
And can I just add a footnote? And it takes us a little beyond our topic, but the OFCCP has also issued a new regulation, a proposed regulation, which is going to change evidentiary standards and make compliance much more difficult. But that's a topic for another day.
That's correct. And that deals with issuing, right, the predetermination notice and notices of violation. But Bert, when you read these together, it suggests that if you didn't do something, at least to their liking, as far as evaluating compensation under the regulation, they're going to issue a notice of violation on that basis alone.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the important thing for our listeners to understand is you have to read these together. This is part of an integrated effort by the agency to expand its regulatory reach onto compensation and all other aspects of an AAP.
Well, it wasn't just OFCCP, David, that talked about on Equal Pay Day, which just for those who haven't had a chance to understand Equal Pay Day, it's the day on which women in America make as much as men in America did at the end of the prior year. So what about EEOC?
Well, EEOC didn't do anything quite as significant as OFCCP did. It didn't announce a new directive or new change in how it's going to conduct enforcement. But it did issue a press release, Chair Burrows, somewhat, I'd say, resting on the agency's laurels, pointing out that they have been very actively engaged under the Equal Pay Act and Title VII for years, focusing on compensation, sort of suggesting that, yes, the cop is on the beat, we're monitoring and we're continuing to enforce. They noted that they have recovered over $65 million under the Equal Pay Act and almost $160 million, $159 million, for Title VII discrimination under basically negotiated or administratively resolved resolutions. Of course, this is over a five-year window. So those numbers, they may sound big initially, but think about that. That's over 5 years. So if you break it down just on average per year, that'd be what, you know, $15 million or so a year for Equal Pay Act. Honestly, most individual plaintiff's lawyers would tell you that's not a very good payday when they bring claims. But also the agency pointed and said that they had rather, I would say, anemic recoveries over 5 years for sex-based wage claims of under $5 million and over just over $12 million for Title VII claims in litigation. So, but those are the best numbers EEOC has. That's what they put out in their press release to note and essentially to drive the point, we're on the beat. We've discussed before the critical MOUs, so there is greater coordination. And I think as the agency's budgets get further sorted, there's going to be cross-leveraging EEOC and OFCCP, and they're going to continue. The overarching message, focus on pay. It will continue to be the top priority.
You know, I don't want to cast aspersions, but there is that motto about keeping doing the same thing over and over again, even though you're not getting a very good result. We've just had a recent example of an Equal Pay Act case. It hit the papers from the University of Miami, where the EEOC yet again brought an Equal Pay Act for claiming millions of dollars in back pay. And not only did they lose, they lost in 30 minutes. The jury took 30 minutes to throw the case out and determine that the employer had a right to have this pay differential. Part of the Equal Pay Act, to be candid, raises a high barrier because any other factor other than sex can be used to justify a pay differential. And that's one of the problems. The agency is seeking a legislative change. Part of Chairman Burrow's lobbying is in favor of the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would adjust and eliminate some of the equal pay factors. But currently, the low return that David talked about is brought clear to us by a recent event where the agency lost big time doing the same thing this year that it's done in the years past.
That's a good point, Bert. Now, Nina, one of the other areas I know the EEOC is going to be grappling with is the collection of pay data. We've talked about that a little bit, and we're still waiting the National Academy of Sciences report. To remind our listeners, You've been part of that process in the past. You were on the panel of experts, outside experts, the first time around. And we have the second panel that's been convened. What are you hearing on that? When are we going to get the report?
Well, this was just to give a little bit of background. I think we talked about it before. As many of you know, EEOC did do a pay data collection a little bit during the Trump administration after they lost litigation over suspending it. And that pay data collection, they collected for fiscal years 2017 and 2018. As a result, former then chair Janet Dillon asked the National Academy of Science to evaluate the data they collected and let them know whether it was worthwhile to collect or not. And in addition, asked for recommendations. And David, you were part of one of the people that the panel talked to about what should be, if they collect pay, what it should look like. David, after you testified, along with a lot of other people, we expect there to be a new report coming out. And that new report, we understand, will recommend to EEOC that they collect pay. But instead of W-2 box 1, which they collected first time, it would be W-2 box 5, which is what California is collecting. And we understand the report is probably in its final stages of peer review at this point in time. But we expect it in the next month or so, I would say, that we will see the report.
So when we sort of weave these threads together, we have the OFCCP with its audit authority stepping up the focus and now putting everyone on notice of these very detailed so-called pay equity reports that we don't see in the regulations, but they've decided through sub-regulatory guidance should be provided. We know that the EEOC is going to be mandating the collection of compensation data. That data will be shared with OFCCP, and there'll be that cross-coordination we've talked about. So it looks, I think, to all three of us that the landscape, the legal compliance landscape, is going to be really filled with compensation and compensation-related efforts by both these agencies, certainly for the next couple of years, I think. Well, we're drawing close on time. I want to give everyone sort of a last shot here and a couple takeaways. Nita, I'm going to start with you. And Bert, I'm going to give you the last word. So Nita, why don't you start?
Well, I think every federal contractor who's going to have to certify to OFCCP, they're in compliance, needs to determine what kind of pay audit they're going to do to meet this requirement. I think every federal contractor is going to have to figure out what kind of pay equity audit they're going to be doing to comply with their certification obligations so that they can say that they are, in fact, in compliance with this. So that's the one that comes to my mind, and it's most urgent.
The one that comes to my mind is the importance of doing a bona fide pay equity, and I mean pay equity vis-a-vis Title VII, as a privileged and separate effort, independent of what you're going to do to satisfy your regulatory obligation as a federal contractor, which I still believe can be much more modest in order to evaluate the compensation systems, which is all the regulations require. Bert?
I'm going to draw back from compensation and remind everyone that the breadth of a company's review of its HR processes should be as broad as what the OFCCP and the EEOC say they are going to be investigating, which means it starts with your recruiting, your hiring, your training, promotion, all those opportunities for advancement in addition to compensation. Because although this is clearly the focus of the agency, it's not the only thing that you and they are responsible for.
I think, Bert, that's what I'd call a root cause analysis. And I think that's right, to determine if you've got pay differences, why are they occurring? And I think that's great advice. Well, I want to thank both Nita, Bert, as we all work remotely. I do want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. Please, if you do not subscribe, consider subscribing to the DC Insider podcast, DC Insider, What Employers Need to Know. Every 2 weeks, we do come and try to bring you the front edge developments, really focusing on Washington and the federal agencies in particular. So Nita and Bert, thank you both. And we wish all of our listeners good health and good day.
Thanks, everyone. We look forward to the next update. For those that would like to connect with any of the lawyers from Fortney Scott, please reach out to them directly by visiting fortneyscott.com. On the website, you can also listen to previous podcast episodes, as well as pick up your copy of the DC Insider Report and sign up for future updates. Thanks so much for listening.